Good evening. This is Ryan Ayala, and you are listening to Outsources, KGNU's weekly news and culture focused radio show for the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer community. On October 26th of this year, Matthew Shepard, who was beaten and left for dead on the outskirts of Laramie, Wyoming 20 years ago, was interred at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. Led by Bishop Gene Robinson, an openly gay pastor in the Episcopal Church, it was not only a moment of ease for the Shepherds as they waited this long to finally lay their son's remains to rest, but an emotional welcoming by the bishop of all LGBTQ individuals back into the church. Here's a clip of the opening words of Bishop Robinson.
This cathedral is actually serious about being a place of prayer for all people. So if you are a person of faith, but not Christian, please know that you are our special guest. Be you Jew or Muslim, Hindu or Sikh or Buddhist or whatever, you are welcome here. And even if you're not a person of faith, if you identify with no particular religious community, please know how welcome you are. Let the beauty of this service, the words and the music, wash over you and comfort you in whatever ways you need to be comforted. And in particular, we welcome those of you who are gay or lesbian. Bisexual or transgender or queer. Many of you have been hurt by your own religious communities. And I want to welcome you back.
Matthew Shepard's death in October of 1998 spread across the nation and began a movement and fight to protect and bring justice to hate crimes upon LGBT individuals. Tonight, I have a conversation with Jason Marsden, the current executive director of the Matthew Shepard Foundation, which has funded and supports such projects as the Laramie Project. I was able to sit down with Jason last week at the foundation, which had images of Matthew in various forms and depictions on each wall on their third floor downtown Denver office. We sat down together to remember his friend Matthew, with sounds of construction in the background, and to discuss the foundation's work 20 years later and why it's still important.
I'm sitting here with Jason Marsden, who is the current executive director of the Matthew Shepard Foundation, which is based here in Denver, Colorado. Hi, very nice to meet you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I wanted to start this interview kind of reflecting on the October 26th memorial service at the cathedral in D.C. And getting your feelings around what that meant to the foundation, what that meant to you as a friend of his, and what it's kind of brought up overall since then.
Yeah, it was a remarkable moment. And going into it, we really had no idea what to expect in terms of public interest, media interest, in the event. The interesting thing about attending that service was the degree to which it let me, as a friend of Matt's, let go of some grief that I didn't realize I'd been carrying around for so long. Matt was a friend of mine, and in 1998, when he died, I had just started dating my now husband, who was a junior high and high school classmate of Matt's. They were in a high school play together. And so when this initially, we learned about the attack on Matt, it was just a terrible thing that happened in our little corner of the world in Wyoming that very few people give much thought to, or in some cases have ever heard of. And within a few days, it became regional and then a national and then ultimately an international news story. And it was a jarring experience for me. I was a newspaper reporter, and I had never been on the other side of a news story. I had never been part of a story that was being covered and in a position to critique the tone or the accuracy of the coverage or wonder about why it did or didn't get as much attention from people as it turned out that it would get. And just within those few days, I think I numbed myself a little bit to the reality that millions of people were following this story and were similarly grieving for someone that they never met or heard of. And we attended the funeral. We saw Fred Phelps and his family with their despicable protest. We saw all the satellite trucks all around the park across the street from the funeral. And it was like a 20-some inch snowstorm that day. Mm. So there were branches breaking all over town. Power was out in parts of town. The city was a mess, physically as well as emotionally. And then the service ended, and everyone left. The protesters left, the media left, and the long post-mourning period began. And one thing a lot of people didn't know when we announced Matt's interment at the National Cathedral is that he had never been put to rest anywhere. The family, at that time, were living in Saudi Arabia. And they were a young family. Parents were in their 40s, my age now. And they were living in Casper, where neither of them grew up. So there wasn't like a grandparents, great-grandparents kind of family plot or a cemetery where they expected to be put to rest ultimately. And so they felt odd about burying Matt in a grave somewhere in Wyoming and then flying 6,000 miles across the globe. And leaving him there by himself. And they thought at the time that the work that they were going to do in his name, advocacy work that they would take on, might last for a few years as the public followed the trials and the ultimate outcome of the case, and that in time, as we usually do, Americans would move their attention on to the next thing that happened. Mm-hmm. And for a variety of reasons, I'm not sure we know all of them, frankly, the story continues to matter to people and have real emotional resonance, even today, 20 years later. But as a consequence of the story continuing and Matt's parents continuing to be visible, they began to become concerned that if they did bury him somewhere, it would become either an attractive nuisance or site of pilgrimages or worse, at risk of vandalism, mm-hmm. Or other intrusions that would affect the other families whose loved ones were resting there. So year after year went by without really a good answer to the question of where Matt should be forever. And they kept his ashes and continued to think something will present itself. And through personal connections with Episcopal clergy and having done some programmatic work with the National Cathedral in the past, the opportunity for him to be interred at the cathedral's crypt presented itself. And at this kind of tender juncture of the 20th anniversary was a really poignant opportunity for the shepherds to say, you know what, yes, this is the right time. The world... This will be a grace note for the world in a difficult time, something we can come together around. And it's secure, but it's also a place of worship and remembrance where people can go and pray or leave a flower or just meditate on the thought of Matt's life and all those like him in a safe setting, in a city that has had a huge amount to do with the civil rights of the LGBT community in the 20 years since his death. It just seemed fitting to them, and the response by the public was overwhelming. The mm-hmm. place was full. There was over 2,000 people there, only a handful of whom we knew. Right. And to be there in that pew toward the front with Judith Light on one side and the former Army Secretary across the aisle from us, thinking about our friend, was emotionally extremely powerful and very welcome release of all the years of personal grief that I've put aside to do work that we do in his name.
When I was watching the memorial service and the interment at the cathedral, I did not expect to get as emotional as I was watching it on YouTube, right? It was pre-recorded. Mm-hmm. It was later in the day. And I think what really moved me was the welcoming back into the church that the pastor did at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And he was even moved to tears and choked up while he was saying it. Did you grow up religious? And what was that experience for you in hearing those words? Did you experience something similar?
I did. I did grow up religious. I was baptized Methodist, attended Sunday school, all the way to confirmation. We moved when I was 11 to Wyoming and changed to a Lutheran church. Not a lot of difference there, unless you ask a Lutheran and a Methodist. and I chose not to go ahead with confirmation. And part of that was, I think, an innate feeling I had already at age 12 that I was out of step with what white Anglo-Saxon Protestants thought about people like me. And it took me a few years before I really acknowledged to myself that I was gay when I was about 14. But I kept that to myself completely until I was 19 years old. And I didn't really come out to everybody in my life until the week Matt was murdered. And all throughout those years, my attendance at church was limited to funerals and weddings, and that was about it. Mm-hmm. And I had not given up my religious beliefs as some kind of lapsed Protestant Christian, but I found myself pretty alienated from what was passing for organized religion, mm-hmm. especially in the Western United States.
Right.
In Casper, if you're not attending an evangelical kind of huge church, and you're not Mormon, likely is not you're Catholic, and everyone else is scattering statistically. And being in that community, I didn't really feel like I was surrounded by people of a sort of moderate Midwestern Protestant faith. Which just made it easier for me to continue to drift mm-hmm. farther and farther from organized religion. And so, although this was, in a sense, a funeral, I think it was the first time I found myself in a church with a hymnal in front of me and listening to clergy actually preach a sermon and not just a eulogy.
Yes.
In I don't even remember how long. And honestly, my husband was brought up in no religious tradition whatsoever and is a scientifically minded skeptic. And when we attended Matt's funeral 20 years ago, I was sitting there, and it's high Episcopalian, so there was a communion service. And people got up to take communion, including lots of young gay men. And I felt not being confirmed and not being at my own church, I didn't want to take communion. But I sat there and watched, and I leaned over to him and I said, "It really does my heart good to see so many gay boys taking communion today." And he said, "Not for me." And I was like, you know, that's right. We have a very different cultural expectation and background around this. And it's one of the few times really in our whole relationship all these years that we talked about our individual religious beliefs and what we do or don't feel. It was gratifying to see. And so sitting with him at that service in October in Washington and singing off the same hymnal page as it were was a new experience for us too as a couple.
Yeah, it sounds like your mind went to a lot of places around what it meant to grow up. I grew up Catholic, mm-hmm. Latino Catholic, and just that struggle, I think, with what's imparted on you growing mm-hmm. up, right, that you can never really truly lose, and the difficulty with finding yourself within that community is something yeah. that I resonate with on that.
Yeah, and if I have any structured religious belief at this point in my life, I'd say it's Buddhist. I joke about my job here at the foundation as being a secular evangelist. I go around and tell people to behave the way they already know they should, but for whatever reason, don't always. Mm-hmm. and preach to them that kindness makes you feel whole and strong, and that the solution to hatred is millions, billions of humans acting in concert to eliminate it from our world. And it's not government. Government can help. It's not the marketplace. The marketplace can help. Hollywood can argue about how much they have or haven't helped in the struggle for equality, not just sexual orientation or gender, but racial, religious, ethnic. But in the end, if we don't choose to make it our business to end hatred, it will survive. Mm-hmm. It's a weed, and in an unkempt yard, it'll take everything over. So our job is, in some sense, as gardeners, stewards of dignity in our creation. Sometimes I'm telling people this, and I'm like, am I a pastor at heart? Is this Amway? What am I doing, you know? I'm trying, with the zeal of the convert, mm-hmm. to make other people feel mm-hmm. something that they maybe don't feel. But by God, Matt Shepard's story is a very effective tool in helping them get there, because what happened to him is cruel, inexcusable, tragic. He's relatable, rightfully, I think, people feel his loss because they know it didn't have to happen, and that in some sense we're all complicit in the creation of the culture that allowed him to be taken from us. And that makes people's hearts open up in a way that attending a political rally or a community meeting or working with other nonprofit organizations on policy issues just doesn't activate people emotionally the way that Matt's story does.
You're listening to Outsources on KGNU. If you're just tuning in, this is Ryan Ayala, and tonight I am sharing a conversation I had with the Matthew Shepard Foundation's current executive director, Jason Marsden. In October of this year, Matthew Shepard's remains were laid to rest at the National Cathedral in D.C. Over 2,000 people packed into the cathedral to remember and honor Matthew. We continue the conversation with Jason as he shares his thoughts around the disproportionate rates of trans women of color being murdered, and how we can fight to end this as a community. We end our conversation discussing what he does to take care of himself, doing the type of work he's doing, and how you can get involved with the foundation.
Matt's story was so significant in starting a new LGBT movement around safety and accountability for crimes mm-hmm. of hate towards LGBTQ individuals. We know that trans individuals, currently especially women of color that are trans, trans women of color are experiencing the same type of violence mm-hmm. and murder rates that are extremely high.
Indeed.
How does the foundation conceptualize what's happening there, relate it to Matthew's story, and say what can be done in helping people to relate to them, right? Because right. there is a relation to a cisgender white male, right, right. who was gay,
right?
But is more relatable than a trans woman of color.
Yeah.
Where do you sit in that?
Well, one thing that I'm really grateful for is that although it took them 11 years, Congress did pass the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes mm-hmm. Prevention Act. And over the years that it was being debated, there were other debates around employment non-discrimination, military service, other elements. And there was a lot of conflict within the LGBT community, such as we can say that it is one community and was then, over trans inclusion. You know, there was a huge controversy with ENDA about whether it would include gender identity. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of people in the movement who I think fancied themselves political realists who said, we can get this through if it's just sexual orientation, but the minute trans comes into it, we don't have a shot. Mm-hmm. And other parts of the community saying, then let them vote it down. It's the right thing to do. We'll come back again and again until it passes. As it turns out, everyone was wrong. It can't pass in any form in a Republican Congress. But one thing that definitely happened and has required an ongoing effort to repair is the rupture between trans people and what some activists call Gay Incorporated, the national level LGBT organizations that and politicians, including Barney Frank, a hero of the community, but not to the trans community in that instance. So one of the things I'm really proud about is that the Matthew Shepard James Byrd Act is trans inclusive, it is gender inclusive, it is disability inclusive, and we worked over many years, over a decade, with representatives of all of those communities to advance a common united front for that legislation. And maybe that's why it took so long,
right.
But it passed the right way the first time it passed. We don't have to go back and amend it. We don't have to continue to be in this trench. That's been done. Now, at the state level, where 95%+ of all crimes occur, it's a complete patchwork. So the biggest problem with protecting the trans community members who are at risk of bias-motivated violence is we need state laws across the country that are gender identity inclusive. There was a terrible homicide in northeastern Iowa a few years ago against a non-binary victim in which Iowa's hate crime law did not apply because gender identity is not one of the protected classes. And the Department of Justice sent a skilled prosecutor there to work for the district attorney to run that prosecution and did obtain a first-degree murder conviction. So there was justice done, but it was not done in the name of bias-motivated crime prevention or response. It was done with the tools at hand, which were not fully adequate to the task. So we feel the trans community of color is at extreme risk of violence in our country today for a variety of reasons your listeners know already, and I won't bore them by repeating, but we feel that if our work to prevent these cases from happening and get them adequately reported on and statistics correctly assembled and laws improved and ultimately offenders served to justice, it has to be done in concert by all intersecting communities. Mm-hmm. It has to involve religious minorities, racial minorities, national origin minorities, the disability community, women's rights organizations, and all down the line. And we're proud we've done that work in concert with them, but we're mortified that it continues to be such a challenge to protect these people, these human siblings and cousins of ours, to bring them the public safety that they deserve and that is doable if we could get people to prioritize it.
Yeah. How do you care for yourself doing this type of work? And what have you learned through this work that has shown you I need to take self-care?
Well, I'm 46 now. I am very aware, in a way I didn't used to be, that I have a left knee. injuries I sustained in my teens and 20s scrambling up rocks in Wyoming, like, are still there, but now I'm noticing them again. So I need self, even if I were like a florist, I would need self-care at this point in my life. But all kidding aside, we see members of our community in trauma all the day long, every day that we do this work, through email, through phone calls, by absorbing the news that's coming inbound, by watching what's going on politically, which is a strain all unto itself. And I talk to a lot of people who are really hurting. And particularly, I talk to a lot of kids, like high school age kids, who are in Laramie Project productions, a fair number of whom are queer and are living their identity in a more public way by being in that play than they ever have up to that point in their lives. And a not trivial percentage of them live in homes with families who do not accept their sexual or gender or romantic identities. And one thing I like to tell them is, you have permission to live in an imperfect world. It is not your responsibility to fix the world every day that you get up. Tikkun Olam and other beautiful philosophies aside, your first duty is to yourself, to your safety, to not getting thrown out of your house, to not placing yourself at risk of exploitation or violence, until you're in a position to provide for your own needs. And that might mean having to be circumspect about your identity around family and close friends and your educators and peers and coworkers. And you don't have to be under 18 for that to be a risk. That's a risk that follows people throughout their lives, depending on where they are and with whom they are surrounded. But you always have permission for the world to be broken. And the world will probably be broken when you go to bed, and it'll probably be broken tomorrow morning, and it'll probably be broken next year. But you don't have to be. You can be whole, and that comes from inside. For me, I like to go camping in the summer. I like to be out in the air, the thinner the air, the possible as possible. I like to stand on top of tall things and look long distances. I love to eat. I have a fondness for a good bourbon. I have a loving spouse, and I draw a lot of strength from that. And in a weird way, I draw a lot of strength from how important this work here is. I feel like I'm doing meaningful work. You know, I'm not to say anything negative about these professions, but I'm not a banker. I'm not in retail. I'm in marketing. I'm not trading commodities. I'm a secular evangelist, and I try to put a lot of love out there, and my goodness, do they send a lot back. And it helps me to remember that no matter what's going wrong, most people are mostly awesome most of the time. And the more you can engage with people, the more of that you can have in your life, and get as much of it as you can while you can.
You've been listening to Outsources on KGNU. Thank you to Jason Marsden for sitting down with me this month to discuss his friend Matthew Shepard and the work of the Matthew Shepard Foundation, for which he is the current executive director. To learn more about the foundation, visit their website at matthewshepard.org. Next week, Janice Bohan talks with Marty Moore from Out Boulder County. Remember to tune in each week at 6:30 p.m. on KGNU 98.5 FM, 1390 AM, and online at kgnu.org. You can catch this show and others from the Outsources Collective at news.kgnu.org/outsources. This is Ryan Ayala, and I'm wishing you a warm and happy week.